It's a bit perplexing how they are taking public comment on a rule that in essence is final.
The state sues over fishery restrictions in the Western Aleutians. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 14th of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Northwest Arctic officials take a closer look at offshore drilling plans.
Our people are going to be here forever, and we need to make sure that our people and our way of life is not threatened.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
A National Marine Fisheries Service decision to restrict fishing in certain areas of the Western Aleutian Islands has drawn the ire of Governor Sean Parnell. Parnell is taking legal action against the federal agency, saying that there is not enough scientific evidence that the fishing closures will help endangered marine mammals. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The restrictions on Atka mackerel and Pacific cod harvests in three fishing areas off the Western Aleutians are aimed at protecting the endangered western population of Steller sea lions. The marine mammals feed on those fish species, and last week the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Fisheries Service, or NIMFS, issued a final interim rule prohibiting fishing for both species of fish entirely in one area and restricting harvest opportunities and catch amounts in two other areas. Today, the state filed suit in U.S. District Court for Alaska against NIMFS over the agency's decision to curtail fishing. Doug Vincent Lang is the state's endangered species coordinator.
We're challenging two aspects. One is the foundational science that National Marine Fisheries Service used to conclude that nutritional stress and thus fishing is affecting the recovery of Steller sea lions in this ADAC area. And the second thing we're challenging is the process that National Marine Fisheries Service used to implement the rules that they've implemented as a result of their jeopardy and adverse modification finding with respect to their biological opinion.
A biological opinion issued by NIMFS says continuing with fishing levels in the affected areas jeopardizes the existence of the Western Steller sea lion. But the state argues that NIMFS failed to make the case that additional fishing restrictions are necessary, and that NIMFS didn't make a connection between facts and its conclusions because Western Steller sea lions had an average annual population growth between 1 and 1.5% this decade and now number more than 70,000 animals.
They hypothesized that nutritional stress was the factor, and they looked at a multitude of variables that could be used to test the hypotheses whether nutritional stress was the cause of the slower than desired growth they wanted in this area. And I think it was like 13 variables they tested. 12 of them had no relationship to nutritional stress. Only one of those did. So the overwhelming weight of evidence was not there to indicate that nutritional stress was the single variable that was causing the slower than desired recovery in this area.
Moreover, the decision is expected to adversely impact local communities. About 900 people are employed by fishing fleets in the area facing restrictions. NIMFS acknowledges that implementation of its decision would cost fishery losses of up to $66 million annually. The state claims NIMFS did not take into account recommendations by the North Pacific Fishery Management Council on the issue, nor did the agency provide adequate opportunity for public input on the decision.
Rule and the public comment period closes after the rule will be put in place. So it's a bit perplexing how they are taking public comment on a rule that in essence is final. And that's part of our process complaint with the way NIMFS is implementing these regulations.
An interim rule bypasses public comment to a degree, according to Doug DeMaster, a federal sea lion researcher working with NIMFS.
If we had enough time to go through all the clearances and finish all the analyses, I think we might have done a final rule. But because we need this on the water January 1, and because there's not 30 days between now and the date where we need to implement the action. The decision was made that we go forward with an interim final rule. Informal rulemaking means that it can be implemented right away. It's waiving the 30-day public notice. It requires a 30-day comment period, and there's an intention or an expectation that it will be replaced by a final rule at some point down the road.
DeMaster says finalizing the rule may require another biological opinion. The western population of sea lions was listed as endangered in 1997 under the Endangered Species Act. NIMS fishing restrictions go into effect January 1st. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Conservation groups may take sides in the state suit filed today against the National Marine Fisheries Service. Mike Levine, Pacific Senior Counsel for Juneau-based Oceana, says 15 years of studies show that trawl fisheries are hurting stellar sea lions.
The state is spending our resources to defend Seattle-based trawl fisheries rather than working towards healthy oceans and sustainable fisheries that will support vibrant communities.
Levine says Oceana had hoped that the issue would be resolved without litigation and has not yet decided on legal action involving the suit. After spending years trying to develop a drilling program in the Arctic, it looks as if Shell might be able to drill an exploratory well in the Beaufort Sea. But before they do, they're working to convince the region's community leaders that they are prepared to handle a potential spill. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Last week, a group of 24 community leaders from the Northwest Arctic and North Slope boroughs traveled out to Unalaska to examine Shell's oil spill response fleet. The federal government has agreed to process the company's application to drill an exploratory well in the Beaufort Sea next summer, and now the company is addressing environmental and social concerns held by officials and tribal representatives. The trip down to Unalaska has been a big part of that. In early November, Shell first approached the group with offers to inspect the oil spill response vessel Nanook and the mobile drill rig Kolik. Both are being moored in Dutch Harbor through the winter. At a distance of 1,300 miles, Dutch Harbor is the closest deepwater port to the proposed well site. After weeks of planning, most of the group arrived on Thursday morning on a charter flight. They were addressed by Shell Vice President Pete Slaby, who oversees Shell's Alaska operations, and they heard presentation about spill response plans from representatives from Alaska Clean Seas and Arctic Slope Energy Services. But the most important part of the day involved getting out on the Nanook and getting close to the Kolik. The Nanook is an ice-class cleanup vessel, and on its deck were many of Shell's spill response tools. Edgar Caldwell, a response operations supervisor on the Nanook, showed the group how the booms and skimmers on board would be used during a spill.
Now, what we also have right here is our absorb roll. In the event of a spill, we'll lay this stuff down on the deck so that any personnel that become contaminated with oil, they can walk on this stuff, lessening the effects of the spill.
While on board the vessel, the questions were mostly technical. The group asked how the tools worked and what sort of backup plans existed in case the equipment failed. But during the question and answer session later that night, the focus was more on the social impact Shell's operations would have. The effect on subsistence harvest was an important topic, as was job creation and support of local schools. Kotzebue Mayor Sikorik Whiting says that while opinion is split on offshore drilling in her community, it's important that area leaders work to be included in the resource development process and have their voices heard, since ultimately, it's a federal government deciding the status of the drilling leases.
The bottom line, once the resource is extracted, our people are going to be here forever, and we need to make sure that our people and our way of life is not threatened so that we could continue to live off the marine mammals and continue to live off the land so we could continue to be strong, thriving Inupiaq people from today forward.
Whiting says that while Shell has done a good job of communicating with local governments and native groups, she's still worried about what a spill would mean for her region. She says that there are often whiteout storms in her area that would make it hard to respond to an emergency. She also has reservations about dumping dispersants or burning oil during spill response, as they could harm marine life.
No matter how techno you are, you can't mess with Mother Nature. And, you know, the surface of the ice, when you see it on the surface, that's just the surface. There's like a ton more on the bottom, and it's just moving on like a little ice cube in a glass of water. But these are big, huge, monumental chunks of ice, and as high-tech as we are and the size of the ships, I still need to I still need to be confident that they would be able to safely clean our waters.
Still, many members of the group were impressed by Shell's response capacity, and many appreciated the chance to get out to Unalaska and see parts of the response fleet. Here's John Goodwin, who represented the tribally operated nonprofit, Maniluk.
Every meeting we have, our concerns were, are they safe? Are they going to do the job? Do they have enough equipment in each vessel, like you guys say?
The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Regulation and Enforcement is currently working on an environmental impact statement for the region. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
A federal judge says Alaska should have a senator in place by the time Congress convenes in early January. Senator Lisa Murkowski has already declared victory in her write-in bid to win back her seat on Capitol Hill, despite rival Joe Miller's court challenges claiming the state mishandled the ballot count. U.S. District Judge Ralph Beislein said today that the state's certification of the race between the Republicans likely won't settle their dispute over the ballot count. He says one of them should be in place, even if that means later having to replace that person when the legal wrangling is over. Murkowski's camp is expressing hope that Beislein can resolve the matter before Christmas. Beislein last month halted certification of the race, pending resolution of the concerns raised by Miller. Miller's case will be heard by the Alaska Supreme Court on Friday. His spokesman, Randy DeSoto, says Miller is prepared to take the case to the U.S. Supreme Court if necessary. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, working to keep kids safe from air pollution.
Typically, the way you deal with indoor air quality is to bring in outdoor air. But if the outdoor air is bad, then you've got a much more difficult issue to deal with.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
A judge has denied a request to block a new state law requiring parents be notified before a girl younger than 18 can get an abortion. Superior Court Judge John Suddick refused the request from Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest, but made some changes in the law that was approved by voters in August. The law takes effect today. The judge removed provisions calling for a fine of up to $1,000 and imprisonment of up to 5 years for people who knowingly violate the law. He also struck a section allowing physicians to be liable for damages. And he made some other changes, including making notification easier. Planned Parenthood says it will continue to challenge the parental notification law in court. New research points to colder Bering Sea temperatures as good for zooplankton. This can lead to better health for valuable fish species like pollock and salmon. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The new research was published in the November 4th issue of Nature magazine. Alexei Pinchuk is a researcher with the University of Alaska's Seward Marine Center. The research he and his colleagues have been doing over the last 3 years shows that cold temperatures in the Bering Sea has resulted in the healthy production of larger zooplankton, like copepods and krill.
It's not just on the impact on the amount, it's the amount of the quality of zooplankton. And those species, they're usually larger as well, so they're better prey for pollock or salmon or whales. So, and they do seem to do better during the cold years.
The last 3 years in the Bering Sea have been the coldest on record, despite a 30-year warming trend. One of the reasons why Pinchuk and others are researching the Bering Sea is because the region provides half of the commercial seafood caught in the United States. Pinchuk has been studying the Bering Sea since 1997, and he has spent the last 3 years gathering zooplankton samples in an effort to see how changes in temperature in the Bering Sea affect zooplankton and how the amount and type of zooplankton affect the diet of walleye pollock. It appears that Bering Sea pollock stocks are rebounding after a 2-year decline. This year, the overall biomass of Bering Sea pollock was estimated at 4.6 million metric tons, and it's estimated that the biomass for next year will be up to 9.6 million metric tons. Pinchuk says the increase in the amount and quality of zooplankton in the Bering Sea could be at least in part responsible for the larger amount of pollock biomass in the Bering Sea. Pinchuk's research is part of the 6-year Bering Sea Project, which has been funded to the tune of $52 million. The Bering Sea Project is being undertaken and funded by the National Science Foundation and the North Pacific Research Board. Pinchuk says the increase in the populations of the larger zooplankton can have positive benefits to several salmon species as well.
During the the last 3 years, we analyzed the diets of three species of salmon, like dog salmon, pinks, and red salmon, and they all show that during the last three cold years, they increased the number of UFAO that is significantly increased in the diet.
Another finding put forward by Pinchunk is the presence of an Arctic sand flea in the Bering Sea waters to the south. Pinchunk notes that young salmon and pollock seem to prefer these Arctic sand fleas over the smaller zooplankton. The results from Pinchunk's research is not all that cut and dried in regards to the impact of zooplankton on pollock and other fish species in the Bering Sea. He says there are pluses and minuses to both warmer conditions and colder conditions in the Bering Sea.
The warmer temperature seems to be good for small zooplankton, which is a suitable food for pollock, which just hatched out of the eggs. But when the pollock is getting bigger, when it's growing during the summer, so the small zooplankton is not good anymore. So it needs bigger, fat-rich, energy-rich zooplankton. So then the larger pollock will not find the food. So it will start to consume the smaller pollock, which is still in the water. So in this sense, the warm year is not really good for pollock.
While the Bering Sea has been experiencing colder temperatures over the last 3 years, temperatures have been going up since the 1980s, and long-term forecasts anticipate that that trend will continue. The data collected by Pinchunk and his colleagues will likely be used by federal fishery managers to better predict the biomass of pollock and other species in the Bering Sea. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The priest removed from his post at St. Gregory Catholic Church in Sitka has left for evaluation at a location in the Lower 48. Father Edmund Peniston resigned the pastorship of St. Gregory shortly after he was suspended by Bishop Edward Burns, leader of the Juneau Diocese, which oversees the Sitka Parish. The move came after church leaders received notice that pornographic material might have been accessed on parish computers. KCAW's Ed Ronco spoke with Bishop Burns, who says the diocese is working to be as proactive as possible in handling what happened and as open as possible about what is known.
Juneau Diocese Bishop Edward Burns made two trips to Sitka to conduct weekend masses and talk to parishioners at St. Gregory Catholic Church about the removal of their pastor.
It was important for me to be present to the people here. It's important for me to share with them where we are and why it is that their pastor was suspended. To be pastorally present to them is also a chance to describe for them what we know.
Father Edmund Peniston was suspended from public ministry on November 14th after a software program installed at St. Gregory alerted diocese leaders that pornographic websites might have been accessed from parish computers. Those computers were turned over to police. As of Friday afternoon, the diocese was awaiting the results of an investigation. No charges have been filed. Burns says the priest is headed to a facility in the lower 48 states for evaluation and assessment.
We want to see whether or not he or any other priest has the capacity to live out a life of priesthood. You're right. It takes a discipline, and there's high expectations in priesthood. And yet we recognize, too, that Christ even called, plain, ordinary men.
Throughout the investigation of Peniston, the diocese has spent a lot of time talking to parishioners and to local media. Burns held four town hall meetings, two in Sitka, one in Ketchikan, and one in Juneau. He says in a situation like this, openness can only help.
Our priests are public ministers. And as public ministers, when there's a moment, a very sad moment, in which you suspend a priest, it raises a lot of questions in people's minds. In order for us to dispel and to answer some of those questions, and also for us to demonstrate the way we have responded is appropriate and responsible, it's important for us to be open. It's our goal to be transparent in all this. And through it all, we recognize the humanness and the frailty of every member in this church. It takes a community to stay strong. And so in order to maintain that strength, it's important for us to be informed. And so it's important for us to bind together. And the openness is just a part of it.
The Ketchikan meeting took place at Holy Name Parish. Peniston was assigned there for the 8 years prior to his arrival at St. Gregory in Sitka. Burns says the diocese is discussing with police whether investigation needs to occur at Holy Name.
The response is we need to take this one step at a time, and so that's how we're proceeding.
The Advent and Christmas season masses at St. Gregory will be led by Father Peter Gorgeous, the church's retired priest in residence. With a Catholic population of about 10,000, the Diocese of Juneau is one of the smallest in the nation, and its priests work very closely together, Burns said. It will be up to Bishop Burns to figure out what to do about a new pastor at Sitka's only Catholic church. In the meantime, he's focusing on caring for the old one.
He's still my brother, and to be attentive to him is important.
This is Ed Ronco in Sitka.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Business Monthly, providing a source for statewide in-depth business news on Twitter at AK Business Month or Facebook. It's almost time to file online for your PFD, and when you do, you can make an impact by sharing just a little with a cause you care about. Celebrate the arts, invest in education, shelter a homeless pet, lend a hand, or even make a wish come true when you pick, click, give to one of Alaska's nonprofits. Visit pickclickgive.org to decide how you will make Alaska better with a small gift from your PFD. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Wintry weather is causing concern in the Mat-Su Valley as cold temperatures combined with high winds could create problems for commuters and home power supplies. Mat-Su Borough Public Affairs Director Patty Sullivan says the National Weather Service has issued a high wind warning for the Mat-Su Valley with gusts projected to reach 75 miles per hour.
So what I'm looking at in the parking lot here in Palmer are high winds, you know, picking up the snow, throwing it across the parking lot, and actually a berm of snow building behind a row of employees' vehicles who might have a little trouble getting out tonight.
Sullivan says the cold combined with wind chill has borough officials worried about Valley residents staying warm tonight.
We want them to have their emergency supplies ready to go in case the power goes out, and hopefully they have an alternate form of heating, such as a fireplace. And if they don't, perhaps they have a friend or a relative or a plan for someplace to go where it will be warm tonight. We're not saying the power is going to go out, but, you know, just that backup plan.
She says the power was off briefly for many Palmer residents today, so being prepared for the possibility is important. Having extra clothing, boots, blankets, and candles in your car is a good idea also. The coldest temperatures so far this season in Fairbanks are forecast for the next few days. National Weather Service meteorologist intern Julie Maligowski says temperatures will fall as skies clear.
As soon as that happens, we're going to have the inversion redevelop in Fairbanks, and we could see temperatures again in the valley go back into the 40 below range, 40, 45. But we're still expecting temperatures to be about 20 below in the hills, and just all depends on where you are in town.
Malangowski says the coldest official temperature registered at the Fairbanks Airport so far this winter was 33 below on Sunday. She says December has been on the cold side over the first half of the month.
Our average temperature for the month of December so far is minus 15.4, and that is a minus 11.1 departure from normal.
Malangowski says normal temperatures in Fairbanks this time of year are a low of 16 below and a high of zero. The Fairbanks School District has lowered the air quality threshold when kids are allowed to play and exercise outside. The North Star Borough School District has dropped the fine particulate pollution concentration level at which activities are moved indoors from 200 to 176 micrograms per cubic meter. District Superintendent Pete Lewis says the move is in response to health concerns.
We've heard from patrons, we've heard from staff members and principals. Obviously, air quality is an issue for us, and we want to make sure that our kids and staff are in a safe situation.
Lewis says the new fine particulate levels for when activities are limited or moved inside were developed with help from borough air quality experts. Pollution is also an indoor issue at local schools, as smoke comes into buildings through air handling systems. Lewis says the district is working towards solutions, but there's no easy fix.
Typically, the way you deal with indoor air quality is to bring in outdoor air. But if the outdoor air is bad, then you've got a a much more difficult issue to deal with. And so we're looking at some different options with regard to the filter systems and that sort of thing, just to see if there's a good solution for us that that might be something that we could look to system-wide.
Lewis says there's special concern about kids with respiratory ailments. He says the school district is also working with the borough and state on an ultimate fix of cleaning up Fairbanks air. True Alaska Bottling has missed its contractual deadline for shipping bulk water out of Sitka again. The lapse does not have Sitka officials particularly worried. TAB missed its deadlines in 2008 and 2009, too. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Both times, TAB applied for and received a contract extension from the Sitka Assembly. Both times, TAB forfeited a $100,000 advance on bulk water it purchased but never shipped. Sitka Administrator Jim Dinley says it's a win-win situation for the city. Sitka has yet to see any revenue from bulk water sales, but the sale of the rights has proven to be a modest moneymaker. Sitka holds a permit to sell 9.5 billion gallons of bulk water per year out of Blue Lake, water which is running into the ocean right now. TAB's contract is for roughly a third of that amount. Sawmill Cove Industrial Park Director Gary White says there is at least one other creditable buyer for some of the remaining 6 billion gallons, Aqueous International. But that company is developing its business plan further before putting up the $100,000 Sitka requires to reserve rights. White says TAB was sent a cure letter on December 8th demanding the export of bulk water from Sitka within 45 days. TAB CEO Terry Trapp has already been in touch. White says Trapp has asked to update the Sawmill Cove board on his company's plans within the 45-day period, and then will likely ask for another extension on the contract. A contract amendment would go first to the Sawmill Cove Board and then to the Sitka Assembly. It will cost TAB another $100,000. City Administrator Jim Dinley says he'll bring the matter to the attention of the Assembly once the 45 days have passed. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Ed Ronco and Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA. ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at achia.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.